Thanks for introduction and for giving me this great opportunity to present my work for the quantum gravity group at PI. So my talk has two parts. The first part is about the U1-cubed model of Euclidean quantum gravity, and the second one is about the first step in the direction of understanding supertranslations in the in loop quantum gravity. Let's start with the U1 cubed model. Okay, this talk focuses heavily on canonical gravity, so let's begin with a brief review of its constraints. Understanding these constraints is important to understanding the dynamics of vacuum gravity in the classical Hamiltonian formulation. So as usual, we have 3 + 1 splitting into space and time. In fact, we have a space-time manifold denoted by M with metric G. The space-time has a topology of sigma cross R. The time evolution vector field governs the time, and each constant time slice is diffeomorphic to sigma. On each spatial slice, the space-time metric induces a spatial metric Q, which serves as one half of the phase-space variables. The other half, which is denoted by pi, encapsulates information about the extrinsic curvature of the slices embedded in the space-time. The time evolution vector field generates the dynamics along the slices. This evolution is governed by the Hamiltonian by the canonical Hamiltonian. It's useful to decompose the time flow vector field into normal and tangential components. These components are parameterized by the lapse function and shift vector. This little n is normal to the slice, and the lapse determines the amount of normal displacement, while the shift controls the tangential movement on the slice. When we take Einstein-Hilbert action and we do Lejeune transformation, it turns out that the diffeomorphism symmetry of the action leads to a Hamiltonian, which is a linear combination of constraints. The specific form of this constraint is not important here, but for now it's sufficient to say that one of them is a so-called Hamiltonian constraint and the other one is so-called diffeomorphism constraint, and we get also some boundary terms. For the first part of the talk, I will be ignoring the boundary terms. We assume there is no boundary. However, I will come back to them for the second part of the talk. It's crucial to understand the role of these constraints. They generate the so-called hypersurface deformation algebra. The spatial diffeomorphism constraint generate diffeomorphisms within the spatial hypersurfaces. In contrast, the Hamiltonian constraint generates transversal displacements of the hypersurface. This implies that the non-trivial evolution out of the slice is governed by the Hamiltonian constraint, and in quantum theory, the corresponding Hamiltonian constraint operator controls the dynamic. Therefore, construction of the Hamiltonian constraint operator lies at the heart of canonical quantum gravity. Before going to the next slide, I want to highlight that the hypersurface deformation algebra is not a true algebra. In the third line, where the Poisson bracket between two Hamiltonian constraints is shown, the right-hand side includes phase-space functions, so it's a Lie algebraic with non-trivial structure functions rather than a Lie group with just a structure constant. We will come back to this point soon. Yeah, the classical constraint, I mean, the classical Hamiltonian constraint is very complicated, function of Q and pi's. And it's complicated both for Lorentzian and Euclidean gravity, and therefore rigorous quantization efforts have faced difficulties. It turned out that the Hamiltonian constraint has a simpler form in terms of Escher-Barber variables. These variables are SU2, Lie algebra valued triads, and its conjugate variable called Escher connection. Here, the index A is tangent space index, and little I is SU2 Lie algebra valued index. We know that from the spatial triads, we can construct a spatial metric. So the E's contain all the spatial metric data, and therefore the conjugate variable A has the extrinsic curvature information. The Hamiltonian constraint then takes this expression in terms of Escher-Barber variables. Here, beta is a real arbitrary number called Immerse parameter, and S is the signature of spacetime. We can see that if we set beta equal to 1 and consider Euclidean gravity for which S is equal to 1, 2, the Hamiltonian constraint takes a very, very simple form. It's an integral over the spatial manifold. There's a factor the lapse with density weight minus 1, and there is a polynomial term with two E's and an F, where F is the SU2 curvature of the connection A. As I said, the main goal in the study of quantum dynamics is to construct the quantum operator corresponding to the Hamiltonian constraint. Since in GR, space-time is itself dynamical and all background objects are fictitious, the guiding philosophy of quantum gravity is that it aims to construct everything without relying on any fixed space-time background. So for this kind of quantization, we need new ideas and techniques behind those of quantum field theory in fixed and often flat space-times. These ideas and techniques were developed by a huge number of people. And then Tiemann constructed the Euclidean Hamiltonian constraint operator in his quantum spin dynamics work. Tiemann also showed in that work that one could construct the constraint operator for the Lorentzian theory from the Euclidean constraint and volume operator. So the first step in this regard is to actually focus on the Euclidean constraint operator, because afterwards we can construct the Lorentzian one, and this is why we are restricting our attention to the Euclidean Hamiltonian constraint operator. So although Tiemann's QSD construction of Euclidean constraint operator is a great achievement, some open problems do remain. There are many ambiguities in the final operator action. Actually, when this operator acts on a spin network, it adds an extra edge to the underlying graph, which is shown by the blue color here. As we have a large amount of freedom in choosing this edge that has to be attached to the graph, there are an infinite number of different allowed regulators to construct the Hamiltonian constraint operator. And every two distinct regulators, which are not diffeomorphically related to each other, leads to different regulated operators whose continuum limits are not the same. And secondly, the constraint commutator between a pair of Hamiltonian constraints doesn't reproduce the correct quantum version of the structure functions. So we call this problem of we call this the problem of dynamics in loop quantum gravity. The problem of dynamics has become a source of inspiration for several other approaches trying to fix quantization ambiguities, such as master constraint program, algebraic quantum gravity, spin foam models, renormalization approaches, and etc. In addition, working on toy models that share essential features of GR, by essential features, I mean general covariance and background independence. Working on these toy models can provide significant insight and primary directions for future progress. For example, two toy models that have been studied in LQG are parameterized field theory and Hossain-Kushar model. These two theories don't model the aspect that the constraint algebra is not a Lie algebra, but a Lie algebraic with non-trivial structure functions. But there is another model introduced by Smolin, which is known as the U1 cubed model of Euclidean gravity. And it's interesting to focus on since the constraint algebra of this model has structure functions similar to the gravitational case. In fact, because the U1 cubed model shares many of the conceptual and mathematical structures of GR, it provides a very interesting ground to test various ideas of full loop quantum gravity. With this motivation in mind, let me introduce the U1 cubed model. Like Euclidean gravity, whose constraints have this form, Gauss constraint, diffeomorphism constraint, and Hamiltonian constraint. And F is the SU2 curvature associated with the Ashtekar connection. If one drops the non-abelian term of the Gauss constraint as well as the non-abelian part of the curvature, one ends up with a new theory proposed by Smolin, known as Smolin's U1 cubed model. You can see that in this model, Gauss constraint is simply partial derivative of the electric field, and it has such a simple form. And the diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraint are the same with this curvature, abelian curvature. This model has some features. Its gauge group is U1 cubed, which is abelian. In this sense, this theory is much simpler compared to the full theory, whose gauge group is non-abelian group. I mean, it's SU2. Hypersurface deformation algebra between Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraint is the same as that of GR. In particular, the hypersurface deformation algebra involves structure functions, and the constraints are at most linear in Ashtekar connection A. As you can see, that the Gauss constraint is independent of the connection, and both diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraints are linear in A. As we know, in the procedure of Dirac quantization, one quantizes the full phase space to get the kinematical Hilbert space and then tries to implement the constraints in quantum level. Dirac quantization of U1 cubed model has already been studied in great detail using electric shift method by Varadarajan and Tomlin. The main idea behind the electric shift method can be explained in this way. They believe that the reason for the successful implementation of the diffeomorphism constraint in quantum theory as a unitary operator is our intuition about the action of this constraint. Actually, one can write easily diffeomorphism constraint using Lie derivative along the shift vector. Now the question is there any way to write the Hamiltonian constraint in this format and then use the intuition to improve its quantization? The answer is affirmative, and by defining the electric shift as a lapse times electric field, one can see that the Hamiltonian constraint can be expressed as Lie derivative along the electric shift. Using these techniques, using these techniques, they could nicely and beautifully reproduce the lapse dependence structure functions in quantum level. However, still there are ambiguities and some steps missing. So it's a good idea to study the model through other methods of quantization, in particular, a reduced phase space quantization. In contrast to Dirac quantization, reduced phase space quantization is a kind of quantization in which one implements the constraints in the classical level and gets the physical phase space, and then tries to quantize this space that doesn't have any gauge degrees of freedom to obtain the physical Hilbert space. The reduced phase space approach has additional advantage that it frees us from the steps to compute, for example, the kernel of the constraints operator and Dirac observables. So let's go to reduced phase space approach. Here the cube is the full phase space and the green surface is the constraint surface, where all the constraints vanish and the black lines on the constraint surface are gauge orbits. Now we can cut the gauge orbits at one point using a gauge fixing condition that is shown by this red plane. Then the reduced phase space can be identified by the intersection of the red plane and the green surface. In fact, the reduced phase space is the equivalence class of gauge orbits, but if you think of the intersection points as representative of their corresponding orbits, then you can imagine the reduced phase space by this blue line. Yeah. There's a strategy to find Dirac observables found by Rovelli and explicitly formulated by Dietrich, which is known as relational formalism. One can construct a gauge invariant function from a gauge variant one, this little f, using a clock t. When the clock takes value tau, the values of the gauge invariant function, this big f, is defined as the value of little f. As I said, the reduced phase space is the equivalence classes of gauge orbits. So if we take the points in the blue lines, in the blue line as the representatives of their gauge orbits, then the values of little f takes then the values that little f takes on this blue line can be assigned to the equivalence class of gauge orbit, to the whole gauge orbit. For example, if the little f takes value 5 at this point, then the big F evaluated at all points of the gauge orbit is equal to 5. So obviously, this big F is a gauge invariant function. Now that we can construct all the observables, we would like to try to find a function on the reduced phase space, which is generating the evolution of the observables and is called physical Hamiltonian. The general strategy to find the physical Hamiltonian is as follows. First, we should solve the constraints for as many momenta as there are constraints. In the case of having just one constraint, it means that we should isolate one of the momenta, say P naught. Then we should take its conjugate variable, say Q naught, as our clock. Then we should define gauge fixing conditions using this clock. We have to make sure that our gauge conditions are dynamically stable. To do this, we can solve the stability equations for some of Lagrange multipliers. In fact, we fixed Lagrange multipliers in this way. And at the end, one is supposed to find a function denoted by little h with this property that for all functions under reduced phase space, I mean f, the Poisson bracket between f and h must be equal to the Poisson bracket between the canonical Hamiltonian and f when we are restricted to the reduced phase space and when our Lagrange multipliers are fixed. One can add suitable matters to the theory and use matters as clocks. There are a huge number of papers in the literature considering relational formalism by adding matter. In fact, coupling matter to GR can make the constraints amenable to be solved for momenta, I mean, this first step, and then to define the clocks and gauge conditions. Yeah, one can apply this strategy to U1 cubed model with this difference that in this case, we don't need to add matter to the system. Look at the constraints of the U1 cubed model. The Gauss constraint is independent of A and is linear in E, and the diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraints are both linear in A. Because of this linearity property, one can solve the constraints for some of the canonical variables and derive the physical Hamiltonian using this theorem that has been proved in our paper. This theorem is about the system whose constraints are similar to the constraints in the U1 cubed model. I mean, CA here is independent of some variables, and the other constraints are linear in those variables. Then we can split our canonical variables into three sets. We use the first set, and in particular UI, to solve the constraint denoted by C. Then conjugate variables to UI, which is VI, serves as a clock to define gauge fixing conditions. Then we employ the second set of variables, and in particular YI, to solve the constraints denoted by CI, and again their conjugate variables, which are XI, serve as a clock to define the other set of gauge fixing conditions. The third set of canonical variables are our physical degrees of freedom. Under these requirements, that these two matrices, these are not usual matrices. In fact, they contain differential operators. Yeah, under these requirements, that two matrices are non-singular, one can show that physical Hamiltonian is simply multiplication of the fixed Lagrange multipliers and the H here. When we are restricted to the constraints denoted by CA and the gauge condition GI. Using this theorem, we investigated several gauge fixing conditions and obtained several Hamiltonian, physical Hamiltonians. Thiemann, in his recent work, introduced exact quantization of U1 cubed model, and in his work used the result of our paper to show that the exact quantization of this model matches with the reduced phase space quantization. Yeah, if you want to quantize this model using covariant quantization, the first thing we need is the Lagrangian of the theory under consideration. First, recall that the U1 cubed model has been formulated in the Hamiltonian language. So the question arises here is which Lagrangian formulation this model derives from? Motivated by how Hamiltonian general relativity with SU2 group derives from Palatini action with SO4 gauge group, our first suggestion was an action whose symmetric group is U1 to the power 6. Here, capital A and B are space-time indices, and capital A and J are in our internal indices running from 0 to 3. This action is similar to the Palatini action for GR, and one expects to get the desired result from it. But after performing the Hamiltonian analysis for this action, we found this surprising result that there are no local degrees of freedom for this theory, and so it's a topological theory. So we have to look for another action. So we introduced another action, which is called twisted self-dual model. It has this property that the zero components, the zero J components of the curvature is related to the other components through this relation. Here, gamma is non-zero parameter, and for gamma equal to plus minus one, it's self-dual, but for other gammas, we call it twisted self-dual action. Hamiltonian analysis of this action shows that in this case, our degrees of freedom is equal to two, and the constraints are exactly what we have in the U1 cubed model. It means that starting from this action, we arrive at the Hamiltonian formulation of the U1 cubed model, regardless of the value of gamma. Finding the covariant origin of the theory encouraged us to work on the path integral quantization of the U1 cubed model, which is the subject of our future work. Let me summarize this part. Undoubtedly, the central challenge lies in developing a quantum theory for gravity. Out of various approaches, we have focused our attention on loop quantum gravity. However, within this kind of quantization, loop quantum gravity, the problem of dynamic arises. To gain deeper insight about this issue, and more specifically, to improve the original formulation of Hamiltonian constraint in loop quantum gravity, its advantages to analyze toy models that share fundamental characteristics with GR. It turns out that the U1 cubed model serves as an interesting testing ground for studying dynamics, but particularly because of the presence of structure function in its hypersurface deformation algebra.
Sepide, before you continue, Bianca has a question.
Yeah, if you can go back to this to the action for the U1 cube model. Here. So you start with a connection which comes from U1 6, U1 to the power of 6.
Yes, first we did that in this
the first, yeah, and then in the second version, is it U1 to the 6?
Yeah, we just introduced this twisted version of using this relation, we just introduced this twisted self-dual model.
Yeah,
actually, when gamma is,
but F is defined from a connection, no?
Yes, it's
so
defined.
What is the group for this connection? Is it U1 to the 3 or U1 6?
For this is this F here, FJ is U1 cubed. Is the connection for the U1 cubed. And
okay,
so we
So fundamentally you have U1 cubed and you define the components F0J by this relation.
Exactly.
And then for the triads, you need kind of I guess
For the triads it's the same as we have. We have half denticized triads here.
So, tetrads. So these are just the standard tetrads then.
Yes, tetrad. Oh, yeah, they are tetrads. Sorry. They are tetrads.
And they transform how under rotation, under SE2 or with SO4? Sorry.
Sorry?
How do they transform under? Under rotations, under gauge transformations.
Yeah,
Are
it's the group is just the U1. What we have here.
So is there a way to say this, that they transform under the self to part of the Lorentz group?
That's what I'm asking. Is it the Lorentz group or is it U1?
It's U1.
It's U1. Okay, so they transform under U1.
Yeah.
So they don't transform actually, because it would be a billion action. It wouldn't do anything. No?
Maybe we can postpone this part of more detailed discussion to after the talk, and let Sibylle continue with the
So now that we have chosen to investigate a Smolin's U1 cubed model, one can adopt the canonical quantization approach and attempt to apply Dirac quantization to the model. Initially, this was done by employing the electric shift method by Varadarjan. Subsequently, Tiemann recently quantized the model using exact quantization, which introduced a different representation. Alternatively, within the canonical approach, one can engage in reduced phase space quantization instead of Dirac quantization. By employing various gauge fixing conditions, this approach allows us to construct the physical phase space and derived physical Hamiltonian that govern the time evolution of observables. Based on these results, Tiemann proposed a representation for a physical phase space of the U1 cubed model that matches with the exact quantization that he introduced. Alternatively, rather than following the canonical path, one can follow a covariant approach for quantizing a theory. Naturally, the initial step in this approach involves determining the covariant origin or action from which the theory stems. In our study, we successfully identified the appropriate action for this model, specifically by starting from this action and conducting a Hamiltonian analysis. We arrived at the Hamiltonian U1 cubed model. Now the subsequent step in this research trajectory involves constructing a spin-four model for the U1 cubed model. I should clarify that we refer to it as the charge-form model, as it's different from the conventional spin-form models by replacing spins with charges. Our current and future projects regarding the U1 cubed model is building up the charge form model. Yeah, it's anticipated that the spin form model resulting from our study may be easier to manipulate from a technical standpoint. point compared to their non-abelian counterpart, and it could serve as an interesting experimental facility for exploring the spin foam approach to loop quantum gravity. The other work is a holonomy as quantum time operator. One of the disadvantages of reduced phase space quantization is that time is not quantized in this approach. The goal of this work is to take advantage of linearity of Hamiltonian constraint operator in holonomy and try to interpret holonomy as a quantum time operator. So let's go to the second part of the talk, which is about the boundary conditions of Ashtekar-Barbaro variables at spatial infinity. Remember that in the first slide of the first part of the talk, we ignored boundary terms. Now, now it's time to give them our full attention and study interesting features that happen at infinity. So to obtain, let me begin by briefly motivate the subject. We all know how a special relativity works. It takes place in Minkowski spacetime, whose symmetries are described by Poincaré group, which is consist of Lorentz group and translations, whose symmetries are described. Actually, these symmetries have some conserved charges based on Noether theorem. Actually, Noether theorem tells us that time translation gives us energy, spatial translation gives us momentum, and rotation gives us angular momentum as conserved charges. But of course, the actual space-time in which we live is certainly not flat. It's cause for the question, how can one define a notion of approximately flat space-times or space-times that looks flat at infinity? This question was addressed in the 60s by Bondi, Metzner, van der Berg, and Seitz. And they came up with the notion of so-called asymptotically flat space-times. And then they tried to compute the associated symmetries, which are known as asymptotic symmetries. And they were fully expecting to get Poincaré group out of this attempt. Because obviously in some long distance, limit general relativity should reduce to special relativity, but they didn't. And surprisingly, they got an infinite dimensional group called the BMS group. The BMS group consists of two pieces. The first piece is an infinite dimensional abelian group of so-called super translation, which extends standard space-time translations. And the second piece is called super rotations. They are an infinite dimensional extension of usual Lorentz group. This group first identified at null infinity. However, in this talk, I want to investigate them at the spatial infinity. But why is it important? One of the reasons for investigating the asymptotic structure at spatial infinity is that we need to understand the matching condition of the fields and charges between past null infinity and future null infinity, which clearly involves going through spatial infinity i naught. And most importantly, we want to investigate BMS charges at spatial infinity because we want to study the quantum features of them in the context of canonical loop quantum gravity. And because the canonical loop quantum gravity is written in terms of Ashtekar-Barbara variables, we need to define suitable boundary conditions for Ashtekar-Barbara variables. So our goal is to study the asymptotic structure of gravity in terms of Ashtekar-Barbara variables at a spatial infinity in the asymptotically flat context. Because, this is important in order to better understand the role of BMS group in quantum theory using LQG techniques. Actually, because we want to study BMS group, we need to study in the context of asymptotically flat spacetimes. And because we want to use LQG techniques, we have to look at spatial infinity and use Ashtekar-Barbara variables.
Sepide, you have about 10 minutes left.
When we have asymptotically flat spacetime, the metric at infinity is in the Cartesian coordinate is just delta, and the metric in the polar coordinate is denoted by this gamma AB. This is the same metric, but it's in this polar coordinate. And Timon, in his work, showed that in the Cartesian coordinate, the falloff conditions for the electric field, Ashtekar variables, is like this. And in the polar coordinate, one can see that this transforms to these conditions. Actually, this ERI is a radial component of electric field, and this EAI is the angular component of it. And the same for Ashtekar variables. And here, these gamma bars are asymptotic triads at infinity. And these are functions that are important for us. These functions are defined on asymptotic two-sphere. And they contain a lot of information about the physics, as we can see soon. So after determining the falloff conditions for the variables, we have to make sure that the symplectic structure is well defined. But if we use this falloff conditions, we can see that there is a logarithmic divergency in the as a symplectic form. And one way to get rid of this divergent part is that to assign parity to these functions, f and g's. So we assign parity even to FRR, FRA, FAR, and GAB. And then odd parity to their conjugate variables. And then you can see that multiplication of this odd function to even function is an odd function. And we know that integration of an odd function over S2 is equal to zero. In this way, one can get rid of this divergency part. So this is called the standard parity condition that they were proposed by Reja Teitelboim for ADM variables and by Timon and later by Campiglia for the Ashtekar-Barbara variables. So this is not the end of the story. We have to make sure that the falloff conditions and the boundary conditions are preserved under hypersurface deformation algebra. And yet we need another requirement that generators of the asymptotic symmetries must be well defined. I mean, they should be finite and they should be functionally differentiable. These actually the constraints are the generators for asymptotic symmetries. To make sure that these constraints are well defined, we need to determine the falloff conditions for Lagrange multipliers too. And these are the falloff conditions for Lagrange multipliers. You can see that this B here is the parameter responsible for boost, F0 for temporal translation, V and WR for radial translation. This YA is responsible for the rotation at infinity. And this ST is the temporal supertranslation, the parameter for temporal supertranslation, and the other one, the parameter for radial supertranslation. To give you an intuition, let me go to this page. Take this cylinder as our space-time with the disks, with this disk as spatial slices, and the circles are our asymptotic two spheres. I have reduced dimensions for simplicity, but we assume that every point of the asymptotic sphere is coordinated by two variables, theta and phi. When we perform a time translation by the constant rate at every point, we move to another spatial slice, and we know that in this case, energy is conserved. Now consider a time translation in which different points are moved in time direction with different rates. It means, you can see here that we moved different points with different rates. And it means that the parameter for time translation depends on our angular coordinate. This angular dependent function is called supertranslation. And if such a translation gives us a non-vanishing conserved charge, it's physically important. So let's go back to this slide. In Timon and Campiglia, in their work, could obtain the well-defined generators for Poincaré symmetry at infinity. But in their work, if one wants to have a preservation on the hypersurface deformation for parity conditions, this ST, this temporal supertranslation, should be odd. And this SR should be even. And then after calculating the supertranslation charge, one can see that this ST, which is odd, is next to this function, which is even, F bar RR, and SR, which is even, is next to G bar RR, which is odd. So because we have an integration of an odd function over S2, it's equal to zero. So it's not physically important. Now, we propose new boundary conditions for Ashoka-Barber variables. Yeah, this is the list of boundary conditions. You can see here that we don't have certain parities for every functions G or F, but the combination of them have certain parities. And then, I don't want to go through the details, but I should say that to make sure that these parity conditions are preserved under hypersurface deformation, we have to fix some of the Lagrange multipliers. And then the transformation that preserves this standard, this boundary conditions are like this, that this ST, this parameter should be even, and this SR should be odd. And when we calculate the supertranslation charge, we can see that, as I said, ST is an even function. I can read the parity of F bar RR minus F bar AA from here, which is even. And then SR is odd, and G bar RR is odd too. So we have, so in general, this this supertranslation charge is non-vanishing. So the charges associated with usual translation and usual temporal translation and usual spatial translation, supertemporal supertranslation and radial supertranslation are all finite and non-vanishing. But it turns out that charges associated with B and YA are not finite. In terms of alien variables, if one sets the leading order term of the constraints equal to zero, the divergence associated with boost and rotation charge is removed. This is proved by Hanno and Trossard. But surprisingly, this method doesn't work in Ashtekov-Arbero formulation. By study the process of obtaining Ashtekov-Arbero variables from ADM variables, it becomes evident that in order to establish Ashtekov connection and electric field as conjugate variables, particularly to show that the Poisson bracket between two Ashtekov connection is zero, it's necessary to prove that the variation of spin connection with respect to the electric field satisfy this equation, which represents integrability conditions for spin network connections. And it means that this spin connection has a generating function. So this F, this generating function, exists for a manifold without boundary and for the asymptotically manifold with the standard parity conditions. But this function is not well defined for the new boundary conditions. And if one wants to keep the connection with ADM formulation, boundary conditions should make F well defined. Actually, we had three requirements to get an appropriate boundary condition, which was well-definedness of symplectic structure, preservation of boundary conditions under hypersurface deformation, and well-definedness of the asymptotic generators. But if we want to work in the Ashtekov-Arbero variables, we have another requirement, which is well-definedness of this F here. So in our future work, we are going to find appropriate parity conditions for Ashtekov-Arbero variables, which produce the full Poincaré, including boost and rotation plus supertranslation charges at spatial infinity. We want to try to figure out how to impose the boundary conditions in quantum level properly and use loop quantum gravity techniques to quantize the supertranslation charges. And once we have successfully accomplished the previous goal, our aim is to determine boundary conditions that not only yield supertranslation at spatial infinity, but also have super rotations. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Sepide, for a nice talk. And we have time for questions. Do we have questions at this moment? So Bianca has a follow-up on the discussion earlier, or Bianca has a question.
Thanks for your talk. So you just mentioned that you want to implement this work on super translations and super charges in the quantum theory for AQG.
Yes.
So now that includes asymptotically flat boundary conditions. So I imagine, I mean, you don't really have an understanding of what the flat vacuum state could look like. So how would you proceed to do that?
Yes, I don't know. This is the problem that we have to investigate future work. I said that one of the problems is that we have to figure out how to impose the boundary conditions in quantum level. Yeah.
So I wanted to know, is there any more concrete idea to do that? Because
at the moment, I don't have any specific idea to do that, but. Uh-huh.
So can I ask a follow-up question? I mean, what implanting these charges, can't you get the vacuum state from implanting the boundary conditions? Like, would that be, instead of saying, oh, I don't know the boundary state, you use the fact that we have these charges to determine the vacuum state.
You mean super translation charges?
Yeah, so I guess if I understood the last question correctly, it was that there's no vacuum state, or the vacuum state isn't understood. But isn't this a way to probe the vacuum state using this method, rather, to give a an argument for a vacuum state?
Probe the vacuum state using this method. You mean which method?
Implanting boundary conditions as charges. I mean, as charges operators. Okay, we could talk later.
Yeah.
I also see a raised hand by Laurent. Laurent?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hello, Sapide. Very nice. Thank you for your talk, which was very, very clear. And you managed to put two different subjects there. I do have questions on both subjects. So let me start maybe with the U1 connection. If I understand properly, in some sense, when you go to this U1 gauge field, you're kind of linearizing the gauge field. So it looks like you're doing some kind of perturbative expansion. So it raises two questions for me. First is that doesn't that mean that somehow there should be a fully perturbative quantization of this system? And if not, why not? And the second one is then, okay, have people investigated somehow the first order perturbation? By perturbation, I mean, imagine that you multiply epsilon ijk by g, or you rescale a by a coupling constant g, which would be Newton's coupling constant. And so, yeah, so maybe the first question is, should I, this model should be kind of a free in some sense if, or not? And solvable in a usual manner, or it's in fact it's not possible.
What was your second question? I didn't.
Well, the second question is okay, what do people know about perturbations? What is the like the G Newton correction to this to this model? But let's start with the first question. In what sense that model is
Yeah,
not a free.
this is, I guess this is not so perturbative. Actually, when we are in the context of this U1 cube model with this constraints, we have the background independency. We are working non-perturbatively. So I don't know what do you mean by perturbative in this
What
way.
I mean is that, okay, when you do, let me explain. When you do perturbation, right, what you do usually is that you rescale the connection and you call it G times the connection, and then you
Yes.
take the limit G to zero. And
Yes.
therefore the terms that you're, so the linear term in A is of first order in G Newton, and the second order quadratic in A is in fact now of order G squared. So you could understand this limit here as a perturbative limit, where you're turning down the coupling constants.
Yeah, I
Right?
understand this as a theory that its connection or its yeah its connection and on the holonomies. I can say holonomies are defined on very very small loops, very small edges. I can understand this in this way. So it's not perturbative. But we are working with something small.
Okay, so what you're answering is that nobody has really looked at, because of this perturbative nature. What I'm saying is that there should be another way to quantize the system. There's the loop quantization, but there should be another usual, more usual way to quantize, and then it would give
You
you a
are
way
saying
to.
that we can apply another kind of quantization to this model, perturbative quantizations to get the results, right?
Yeah.
Question. Yeah, is the vacuum of this non-perturbative quantization is it parity invariant?
It's what invariant?
Parity. Or is the vacuum itself parity breaking?
Sorry, I couldn't understand.
Does the vacuum, if you define the one cube model, it has a vacuum. Does that vacuum positive parity or negative parity?
Positive parallel or negative parallel?
Parity.
Parity. I don't know. I didn't see anything about the vacuum of this model.
Okay.
Of this model. I haven't seen that before. And I haven't worked on it, so I don't know the parity of that.
Thank you. Laura, did you also have a question on the second part?
Yeah, I do, but maybe someone else has a question. I can wait my turn.
So I don't see any other questions online or in the room. So
okay. I have a question about the second part. I mean, of course, it's very involved, the details there. Maybe one question is about, can you tell more about the connection of your work with the work of the group of Marc Hainaut? Because I know that Marc and his group has been developing a lot of, you know, the notion of a space-like asymptotic infinity, and also I've kind of relaxed I worked on relaxing these parity conditions or twisting them. Can you say a little bit more, maybe? Yeah, develop this slide.
Actually, you're right. Hainaut and Trossard worked on the BMS group at spatial infinity in terms of ADM variables a lot. And you're right, the twisted parity conditions, we are working on them now. We are applying the twisted parity conditions in Ashtekov-Barbaro variables, and we hope that we can get some results. But I'm not sure what will happen at the end, because the calculations are very lengthy and it takes time to get the final result.
Okay. And then maybe another condition on this, I want to understand this integrability condition. So you're saying, did I understand properly what you were saying, that if you work in this generalized Ashtekar phase space, then you can implement these boost and super rotations, right, at infinity?
You cannot.
I thought, okay.
Yeah, actually,
I thought the previous slide you were saying you
can. The charge is associated with them. Actually, we can implement the super translations at spatial infinity, and the charge associated with super translated is non-vanishing in general. But about the boost and rotation.
Okay, they are not finite. Okay.
They are not finite, yeah. And okay. In sort of work, they get rid of this divergent part of the boost charge and rotation part by setting leading term of the constraints equal to zero off shell,
mm-hmm.
and then they could rid of this divergency. But in this Ashtekov-Barbaro formulations, when we do that, the divergent part is not removed.
Okay, and then I try to understand maybe more about this integrability condition, which you're right is the one you need to go down. Are you saying that some other phase space of Ashtekar is bigger in the sense that this integrability condition is not satisfied by the boundary condition you were imposing? Or could you explain a bit more?
Actually, we need this generating point. If you want to just work with Ashtekar-Barbaro variables without referring to ADM variables, then we don't need to take care of this generating function. But if you want to keep the connection with the ADM formulation, mm-hmm. we have to have a well-defined generating function, because we want to have ADM variables and Ashtekar variables to be canonically transformed to each other. But for this canonical transformation, we need this condition. Otherwise, the Poisson bracket between two Ashtekar variables is not zero.
Mm-hmm. And so what I try to understand is, you try to implement this, and then it means, is it in conflict with the boundary condition that you were imposing before? This condition is not satisfied in your phase space, or what is the statement?
They are satisfied, but with those, actually this generating function have a boundary term, has a boundary term, and this boundary term is not finite with our new boundary conditions. So this F is not well defined in our boundary conditions, but with the standard parity conditions, where we don't have super translations and super rotations, actually the charge of super translation and super rotations with the standard parity condition is equal to zero. In that case, this F is well defined. So we need to modify our parity conditions in such a way that we get this F well defined.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Right. Are there any other questions?
Quick question. Is the model related at all to the model that Costello and his friends have been studying, which they call self-dual gravity?
Self-dual gravity?
Right. Costello and some collaborators, the mathematicians, have been studying something that looks closely related to this. You don't know, let's discuss. We can just discuss it later.
Sorry, I didn't understand your question.
What Lee is saying is that recently there's been a lot of people, mostly related to twister theory, that have proposed quantization for the SU2 version of your self-dual model. And it would be interesting for you to kind of connect to that literature. So this model has been studied in the literature recently a lot. The action, I'm talking about the action principle. And people have developed mostly twister methods to quantize this theory.
The
SU2, which would be the non-perturbative version, which would be, and the U1 cube, presumably your model is like a zero coupling limit of the fully non-linear theory.
I see. I don't know what's...
I mean, you, or maybe it's different, but you, maybe that's what Lee was mentioning.
Yeah, and now the question is that what is the result of...
The relationship, I guess.
Yes.
Applying that
method. What is the relationship with this work?
Oh, what's the relationship with this? This, I don't know. I don't really know that. The relationship between these two.
Okay, well, maybe we could discuss it later.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a very interesting time.
I don't see any further questions, and we're also running a little bit over time. So let's thank CPD again. Let's talk in the discussion.